From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Three of the four Minneapolis police officers now charged in connection with the death of George Floyd will appear in court today for the first time. And a public memorial takes place in Minneapolis this afternoon for Floyd, whose death in police custody last week sparked another night of mostly peaceful protests across the United States.
In Washington, President Trump is responding to scathing criticism of his decision on Monday to clear protesters away from the White House. His defense secretary, his first one, General James Mattis, wrote that Trump is the first president in his lifetime who does not even pretend to try to unite the American people. Washington Post national security reporter Missy Ryan is here to give us some perspective. And Missy, why this public rebuke from Mattis now?
It's a good question. He kept silent for a long time, for more than a year. And it came just a few days after the another extraordinary moment, which was a photo op that President Trump held in Lafayette Square shortly after protesters had been forcibly cleared. And on the margins of that event was Defense Secretary Mark Esper and General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And their presence at this photo op, given the circumstances and the use of force to clear protesters shortly before that, really prompted a lot of criticism, unusual criticism from former military leaders, and was sort of seen as emblematic of what's wrong, military involvement in this unfolding situation in the nation's capital and elsewhere in the United States. And it really has caused a lot of tension. That, and then, of course, the deployment of National Guard troops, the discussion of using active duty military, has really, I think, prompted a lot of tension and a lot of soul searching within the military about what their position should be.
Mattis also wrote, "We must reject any thinking of our cities as a battle space that our uniformed military is called upon to dominate." And Esper broke from Trump after saying active duty military troops should not be sent to control the wave of protests in our cities. But he is also under fire for referring to protest zones as battle spaces. He tried to walk that back yesterday. Let's listen.
In retrospect, I would use different wording so as not to distract from the more important matters at hand or allow some to suggest that we are militarizing the issue.
Is Esper's job on the line now?
It is. We understand from our sources that the White House and the president have not been particularly happy with Esper, and the perception yesterday that he was breaking with the president, who issued on Monday evening a threat that he might use the legal means at his disposal to send active duty troops or take control of National Guard troops in American cities. And so I think what we're seeing with Secretary Esper is an attempt to thread the needle. He's a political appointee. He works for President Trump. His job is to carry out President Trump's policies. At the same time, from where he sits at the Pentagon, he's trying to protect the institutional interests. And one of those for the military is remaining out of politics and remaining nonpartisan. And so he has, in certain instances, thrust himself in hot water. The remark about the battle space did not go over well with many civilians and also many current and retired military. But in other instances, he's trying to at least draw some line. I think that his remark yesterday about not believing that the Insurrection Act should be invoked was more qualified. He meant it to be more qualified than perhaps it came across from speaking with people at the Pentagon after his press conference. We were told that he was trying to say, not right now. He's leaving that on the table. He would support invoking the Insurrection Act if the conditions change significantly.
How has the president in the White House responded specifically to Mattis?
Well, a few hours after Mattis's statement came out, the president tweeted about it and said that he was glad that Mattis was gone and that he was the most overrated general in the world. And, you know, I mean, it's not an unusual kind of comment to hear from President Trump about a former aide. So, you know, I think that the comment from President Trump isn't going to alter the perception or the impact that that Mattis's statement has for many serving and retired military.
That's Missy Ryan. She's a Washington Post national security reporter. Missy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today, the Labor Department reported another 1.9 million people filed for unemployment benefits last week. That makes the total number in less than 3 months more than 42 million. Joining us now is Julie Niemann, an analyst with Smithmore and Company in St. Louis. And Julie, what is your reaction to these new unemployment numbers? Do you think that things are getting better because the numbers of new claims are coming down, or getting worse when you look at the big picture?
This is entirely different than the last two recessions. The last two recessions were caused by technology. That was the 2001. And then we had the 2007 situation, whenever you had an economic collapse due to financial malfeasance. This one was an engineered one. And so we've got an entirely different unemployment number here. Nobody could have anticipated how large this was going to be, nor how persistent it's going to be. And that's the danger right now. This number may not come down for some time, even with reopening. So it's the big unknown right here. The stimulus has not been enough. And it's not stimulus, it is support. It's unreasonable to even think of this as stimulus at this point, because stimulus would kill the economy. So the support that is necessary to bring people off the bottom and give them sustenance still is not there. So we have a situation now where the people who need it the most are not getting it. And this is entering into crisis proportions. Overlay this with what's going on with the rest of the economy and the political situation involved with racism. We have an absolutely devastating situation right now. James Bullard, who's the head of the Federal Reserve here in St. Louis, gave us about a month ago about 2 months to get this straightened out and to get more support into the economy and dealing with turning the economy around. But we're down to just a few weeks now. And his anticipation was this could turn into a depression, a full-blown depression.
Well, that's my question to you. Are we looking at a depression in your view, or is this just going to be a deep recession that turns around very quickly once there's a vaccine or a treatment that makes the virus not quite as much of a problem for the economy as it has been?
Well, that's the problem. It's based on hope. We've never been able to engineer a vaccine in short order and on command, but everybody seems to think that this one is just around the corner here. This is an economy that cannot afford a long delay for that. Getting completely out of it will depend upon a vaccine. But in the interim, what we need is support to keep people away from desperation, because it's hitting a whole different level of the economy. 40% unemployment could be a possibility in the not-too-distant future if this turnaround or if this reawakening of the economy does not come in pretty speedy fashion. But it's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, we start cooking the economy again, then we get the next relay or the relapse with COVID.
So what do you make of the stock market? Why does it seem to be so disconnected from the picture that you're painting right now?
The stock market is looking at the huge amount of cash that the Federal Reserve is pouring into the economy. They basically put a put under the stock market and under the bond market, because the spigot is going to be on for a long period of time. So when you've got that amount of cash still moving into the economy, where is it going? Well, it's going into the stock market. There's still a lot of investing going on, borrowing at low interest rates. I would not be a bit surprised to see mergers and acquisitions pick up simply because it's politically unacceptable right now to do stock repurchases or to increase CEO salaries. But companies will find other ways of putting this free cash or low interest rate money to work.
Well, why don't they just hire people with that money, Julie? Why is that so difficult?
There has to be demand. You know, if you're going to put people to work, what are they going to make? What are they going to do? Right now, demand has fallen off the face of the earth. People are starting to save again, which is anathema to a growing economy. So where's the demand going to come from? Well, we're seeing globalization absolutely shrink. You know, there goes a large portion for your export markets. So the demand has to be there to hire people to do jobs. And that's what's going to be the biggest problem. Where is the demand?
So what would your message to Congress be as they consider what will be in the next package that they will offer up for support?
This really has to be something that has to be taken over on almost a concerted, organized, systemic federal level. Everybody has to have the same thing. The problem is we're having unemployment benefits run out very quickly in some states versus others. That can't happen. State of Missouri here gives you just a few weeks before you can be unemployed without having benefits cut off. Well, that's not how long this is going to last, and available jobs just aren't out there. Nobody can go back to work because of COVID. So until you change the policy, the consistent policy for unemployment and getting support money out to people, this is going to be a self-fulfilling promise of getting worse, not better.
That is Julie Niemann, an analyst with Smith Moore and Company in St. Louis. Julie, thank you as always.
You bet.
It feels like nothing in the news these days makes any sense. So Hassan Minhaj turned to his father and his faith for answers.
He said, don't worry about the number of questions. Just worry about which questions become more clear and solidified.
Comedian Hassan Minhaj on how his spirituality is getting him through. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
In moments of crisis, music is sometimes helpful. On our regular segment, The DJ Sessions, we've connected with DJs in France after the terrorist attack there, in Orlando's gay community after the Pulse nightclub shooting. And today we're joined by two podcasters who have in the past given us a glimpse into the world of hip hop in Atlanta. Brandon Peters and Maurice Garland are co-hosts of the podcast Day One Radio, and they're with us from Atlanta today. Guys, welcome back.
What's going on,
man? Thank you for having us.
Well, and first of all, let me just ask each of you, starting with you, Brandon, how are you guys doing amid everything that's going on?
It's rough. It's definitely rough. I feel like we're living in unprecedented times for various reasons. And as a black man living in America, it's a day-to-day struggle, but I'm maintaining and pushing through as well as I can.
It's definitely draining. You know, you like to think that we are in a part of American history where, you know, things are not as bad as they once were as far as like stuff that we saw in our history books. But you really can't say that either, you know. So like it's definitely draining.
Well, you brought us some music today that reflects, if not the protests, at least the moment that we are in right now. And before we hear it, I just want to ask you how you went about picking these songs.
This is Maurice talking. The songs that I selected, they rest between, you know, songs that like shaped how I think today. Like, you know what I'm saying? One song is a song that I heard for the first time when I was 15, and it still rings true to this day. And, you know, so that's what I applied, you know, to selecting my songs. And it's like, I got a level with you too, man, you know, because I know we're on, you know, National Public Radio. And we can't play every song. So, like, you know, when we were asked, like, hey, man, can you sing clean versions? Like, that was a challenge because, like, it's kind of difficult finding clean versions of songs for times like this. You're not going to find any songs like that on Kids Bop.
Okay, absolutely. Well, let's hear the ones that you have brought us. I guess they're either the clean versions or we're just going to be doing some bleeping here. But the first one is Holler If You Hear Me. This is by Tupac. Here we go, turn it up, let's start from block to block. Now, Brandon, for people who cannot follow as quickly as Tupac is rapping there, tell us more about this one. This is from 1993, but tell us more about this one and what he's saying.
Yeah, so Tupac released Holla If You Hear Me when he was 22 or 23 years old. So let that sink in for a minute for somebody that's that young to be able to express themselves in this way so sincerely and so eloquently at such a young age. Is amazing, and the song is kind of a rallying cry for sure. So if you can't keep up as you said with how fast he's rapping, definitely go to genius.com, go to your favorite streaming service is, and sit down and listen to the song for sure. It's speaking straight up angst and anger and hopelessness and aggression towards a situation that we're still facing today from a super genuine perspective from one of the best poets and artists that's ever walked this earth.
Okay, well, the next one that we're going to hear was actually just released a few days ago by Terrace Martin in collaboration with other artists, including Denzel Curry and Kamasi Washington. This is called Pig Feet. Rather direct than stay broke. I'm staring through my rearview and my pitch black gloves. My notes reappeared, disappeared. This wicked here, tragedy all over the screen. Like William Shakespeare plays. Disease, the great increase. Grenades, disease, the AIDS. I seize today, like wave. I fade away, I pray today. Cause life is crazy. Jay-Z is scored for hard knocks. They want us crucified with stones and hard rocks. Now, Brandon, I assume that pig feet is a reference to the cops, not the delicacy that some people enjoy.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that Terrace, who is a friend of the show and a supporter of our podcast, Day One Radio, summed it up himself best when he released the song. He says, someone asked, how do I feel? I told them hurt, fearless, angry, aware, and fully ready to protect me, my family, and my people at all costs. I got together with black men that felt the same way and created a work of truth. So those people he worked with are Denzel Curry, who's from Florida, and Daylight, who's from L.A., who are speaking to issues they face in America from opposite sides of the coast, somewhat different cultures, but it still, you know, permeates across the board. And like you said, it just came out at the beginning of June, but it's right on time for what we're dealing with right now.
All right. Well, the next one comes from Maurice's list. This is called Cell Therapy by Goody Mob. Me and my family moved in our apartment complex. A gate with the serial code was put up next. They claim that this community is so drug free, but it don't look that way to me. Cause I can see the young bloods hanging out at the store. 24/7 drunk is looking for a hit of the blow. It's powerful. Oh, you know what else they trying to do? Make a curfew, especially for me and you. The traces of the new world order. Time is getting shorter. If we don't get prepared, people, it's gonna be a soda. My mind won't allow me. Now, if people recognize this, it was actually the only song from Goody Mob to ever crack the top 40 back in 1995. Maurice, that's CeeLo Green with the verse there. Tell us about this one.
This was a verse that really permeated a lot of souls when it came out. Because, you know, like the first half of it, he's talking, you know, specifically to like a lot of the black experience as far as like, you know, you're living in an apartment complex. They put up a gate. Some people can get in and some can't, and some people can get out and some can't, you know. But then specifically on the back end of that verse, he starts talking about, you know, curfews being put in place, which is something that we're seeing right now in response to protests. He's talking about, you know, he's foreshadowing the new world order, which, you know, a lot of people have written and talked about that. But I mean, even in a time like now, a lot of people are calling for a new world order, some in a positive context. And others are expecting a new world order in a not so positive context. The fact that it came out in 1995 is similar to what Brandon was saying about Tupac. Like, these gentlemen wrote this song like when they were in their early 20s, you know, fresh out of high school, still finding themselves, you know. So it says a lot that a lot of things in this song are ringing true 25 years later.
All right, well, the last one that we have time for is from Dead Prez. This is called Down. Rule number one, when we ride, we follow the plan. There's a role for every man with a chain of command. Even when it hit the fan, anything get out of hand, we still stand. To me, being down mean more than being friends or kin. We comrades and struggle through any trouble. Sacrifice my life in combat for you. So you know I gotta love you. I'm down for my brothers and sisters. The system, bust your pistols, I'm with you. Let's put a rag on your face when you ride. You don't want them satellites to take your picture. We gotta have a lot of discipline to win. And come from within is not something you pretend, homie. A lot of be talking that when it really goes down, they be gone when the wind, homie. Can't be no Maurice, tell us about this one and why you picked it.
I mean, that whole album that this song appeared on, Revolutionary But Gangster, which dropped around 2004, I believe. This is one of the standout tracks, and the reason I picked it is because, like, it's kind of giving you like a manual on how to maneuver in times like this and what you should be looking out for, especially when he's talking about, you know, if you're going to be out there protesting, doing a lot of this stuff, put a rag on your face. You don't want to get your picture taken, but it's crazy now. Like, everybody kind of has to have a rag on their face at this point because we are also in the midst of a global pandemic that has not ended yet, you know. And he's also talking about actually organizing when he's saying, you know, You got to create a chain of command so that even if the leader gets taken out or displaced or anything like that, there's going to be other people that can, you know, pick up the mantle after that. And also there's a line where he's saying, you know, you really can't tell who's down just by a tattoo or a handshake. It starts with, you know, being down from the start, you know, in your heart. And it's like we're even seeing that now, too, when we see reports of, you know, a lot of these protests and movements getting infiltrated by people that are disguising themselves by trying to blend in, like, oh, okay, you know, so I'm down with you, and like they're really not, you know. So like I picked this song because it's pretty much like a manual on how people should be maneuvering while protesting in these times.
You know, the interesting thing is we've heard a couple of songs from now and a couple of songs that happened right after Rodney King, and I wonder if you both think that something meaningful will come from this movement right now as opposed to in the 90s.
I believe that, well, I believe that something meaningful came from the movement in the 90s as well. We saw one of the largest gang truces in American history happen post the Rodney King verdict out of Watts in California. I feel like one thing that I'll give credit to a recent guest of ours, Tiffany Roberts, who's an organizer and attorney here in Atlanta, the verdicts of these trials do not dictate the success or lack of success of the movement. This is an issue that's been going on for hundreds of years in this country. It's an issue that will continue to go on if we don't continue to fight. And I feel like a lot of these songs do inspire those who are in the street and those who are behind the scenes fighting and pushing for a better way.
I have touche to say to that. Touche.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Maurice Garland and Brandon Peters, co-hosts of the podcast Day One Radio. Guys, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Start with the heart being down is an attitude. Doing what you gotta do for the crusade. My definition of a soldier, revolutionary, military minded, ready for whatever. Hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. Stay aware, be alert, bomb first, no
tell me, are you down when it's going down? You got to hold it down. Don't talk it, put it down. Homie, tell me, are you down when it's going down? You got to hold it down. Don't talk it, put it down. Homie, tell me, are you down?
The pandemic has put many projects on hold, including a co-housing community for LGBTQ seniors. It's believed to be the first of its kind in the nation. There are now efforts in Durham, North Carolina, to put the finishing touches on this development, and residents are now actually moving in. Laura Pelliser, a member station WUNC, reports.
5 years ago, retired couple Pat McCauley and Margaret Rush came up with a bold idea: building a community where LGBTQ seniors would feel at home, says Rush.
We wanted a place where we could hold hands, we could kiss each other, you know, hello or goodbye, and our relationship would be honored and respected.
Rush and McCauley founded Village Hearth Co-Housing. It's believed to be the first co-housing community in the U.S. built specifically for LGBTQ seniors and their allies. Nearly 30 pastel-colored bungalows branch off cement walking paths that intertwine through the neighborhood in North Durham. Rush says she and McCauley see the 55-plus community as an opportunity to cut through some of the unique challenges LGBTQ individuals face as they get older.
We also have seen and heard and read horror stories of people once they need to go into the standard medical model. They are forced to go back in the closet because it's not safe, or the people taunt them or whatever. And it took Pat and I forever to come out of the closet. We were both really late bloomers. And we don't want to go back in.
Tim Johnston is the Senior Director of National Projects at SAGE, an advocacy and service organization for LGBTQ seniors. He acknowledges that risks exist for these seniors in traditional retirement communities.
It could be substandard care, such as having their call bell answered more slowly than the other residents, or their food always arrives cold. And in some instances, we've heard of physical or verbal abuse.
LGBTQ seniors are less likely to have children and often lack the same social net as heterosexual seniors. Pat McCauley says for her, co-housing is the perfect fit.
We can have a balance of privacy and community. So Margaret can be as extroverted as she wants, and I can choose when I want to be social and when I want to be private.
We are going to be having a community garden to grow vegetables and fruit.
Among the new Village Hearth residents are Alan Keach and Christopher Ross. Before moving to Durham, the couple built an eco-friendly house on a sweeping 58-acre property in Southern Virginia. But they soon discovered that privacy could also mean isolation. And Ross says that didn't always feel comfortable.
Yes, there were two or three other gay people in this town, but it was always, a whisper. Yeah. It's okay as long as you don't make noise about it.
Now Keach and Ross are excited about their new neighborhood. At the end of May, Keach, Ross, and a handful of others started to move in. Ross says there's pressure with being the first group of LGBTQ seniors to create this kind of community. In the end, the need to age and to live on their own terms wins out.
We're coming here to live, not to die. And this might be our last stop, but we're coming here with a very different attitude.
For Here and Now, I'm Laura Pelliser.
As we watch thousands of people around the world protest against police brutality and racism, how do we begin to understand the ways systems of oppression are created? One scholar says one important step is to interrogate what it means in this country to be white. Claudia Rankine is an award-winning author and professor of poetry at Yale University, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Tanya, for having me.
Yes, so interrogating whiteness, it's such a simple but profound idea, especially in light of the fact that anytime we talk about racism, we're kind of interrogating the oppressed. For instance, in this moment, what it means to be black in this country. Your reframing feels foreign. And you even felt at the start of putting together your class, Constructions of Whiteness at Yale University, that you'd receive backlash from it. Say more.
So to switch the lens would be to have everybody in the room. It was like we were having a conversation, but only half of the people involved were in the room. So you had, white people saying they wanted to talk about race, but they only talked about people of color or blackness. They didn't understand whiteness as its own construction leading to the treatment of black people or people of color. So it was sort of a kind of switch. And obviously I wasn't the first one to do it. There was a movement in the 80s, Toni Morrison wrote
yes.
Playing in the Dark. But you just have to keep at these things until finally it sort of clicks in the culture.
Your work is also bringing to mind for me something that scholar Eddie Glaude said about systemic racism, that yes, black people at this moment are crying out for justice, but that racism is a white people's problem. And I'm paraphrasing here because there is actually nuance to this, as you know, but he's saying that it's up to them to fix it. What are your thoughts on this?
I hear where he's coming from, but I think it's all our problems at this point. I ask myself, what ways am I complicit? When am I not speaking up when I should be speaking up? Because as we're in this culture, somehow we must have allowed things to happen to get to this moment. It's fantastic what's happening with the protests. So, it's a democracy. And if what we want is a democracy, then it's all our problem.
Right now, a lot of white people are making efforts to be sympathetic and empathetic. And you've said that there is no mode of empathy that can understand you can die for simply being black. Can you explain the limits of empathy and what role it plays in these conversations?
I admire the desire to wish to understand, but I think one could also understand that there is no understanding what it means to have generations of trauma and to have to sustain that. And to know that at any moment you could be killed in the way that George Floyd was killed. But white people can understand that they cannot be me and still understand that there is a problem.
So I want to go back to something you were saying about this being an everybody problem that we all need to take on. You and I, however, are two Black women who are having this discussion about cross-racial conversations, about racism. And historically, this kind of work, though, falls heavily on educating white people about being Black. You're making the case for something different.
Well, I think we all need to be educated. I really believe that unless we start talking to each other and staying in the room and sustaining the conversation, we'll never get beyond it. And that kind of work has begun. I think what we saw and are seeing in protest are not just random people going out into the street. Black Lives Matter formed Say Her Name, Kimberly Crenshaw, and Surge Showing Up for Racial Justice. They have been working with other grassroots organizations to educate people, to begin conversations, to begin cross-race conversations. And now we see people able to mobilize and come out and have those conversations. So I think this is a collaborative discussion over years that has been going on. And it has to be, because if it's not, we will just have the continuation of a white supremacist orientation that is, unfortunately, right now the governing power base in this country.
In interrogating whiteness and you teaching the interrogation of whiteness, it's not easy work. It's messy. It's painful. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, all, you know, teaching it or even just having conversations with your neighbor, your friends, it's difficult. We all are projecting onto things in terms of what we want as our expected outcomes. All of that is happening all the time. And yet we can't not have the conversation. I think Robin DiAngelo has talked a lot about the fragility of white people in these conversations, how they feel victimized. They see any critique of the system, any reminder of the injustice as a personal affront rather than understanding themselves as part of a system and investing in that change. And part of the change is looking at the truth. And so I think, you know, a lot has to happen. You have to navigate people's feelings. You have to navigate truth telling. You have to figure out where the facts that are reliable are coming from, all of that.
I want to also ask you about mourning. So in 2015, you wrote in the New York Times about a friend telling you that the condition of Black life is mourning. And of course, the other side of this is also joy and resilience. But you make the case for sustained national mourning. Can you say more about what you mean and really how this might help shift how we understand death and race in this country?
Well, I think, I think this is what we're seeing. A national, international response to an event that was horrific. What I was asking for is that can we see Black people as people and have the same human response we would have for the death of anyone and understand that these kinds of deaths, it's really a death inside America. It's a death of America. It's a death of democracy. I actually feel both sad and hopeful by what I'm seeing now.
One thing I'm also hearing from you, though, Claudia, is also a reframing of this problem, not a Black community problem, but an American problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a distinction that I think is important in your work, because so much of what we're hearing is that this is happening to Black communities versus this is happening to America.
Exactly. Another way to look at it is to, you know, COVID. The minute we learned that people with underlying conditions were more subject to the virus and that white people were not as vulnerable as Black African Americans, people wanted to throw out their masks because what happens to African Americans doesn't matter in their worldview of what it means to live relationally as an American citizen. And so, you know, the same thing was happening in terms of racism, they didn't really feel like it had to do with them, which was, of course, ridiculous because racism doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's about how this country exists and who we vote in and who controls how our government works, which is why, you know, this is probably one of the most important elections we will have ever.
That's poet and writer Claudia Rankin. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The coronavirus has pushed major brands like Adidas, Old Navy, and Disney to sell new products. They're now in the business of making face masks. Same with countless smaller sellers on the e-commerce website Etsy, who pivoted to meet the soaring demand for masks even before some of the big companies. Orjen Rushanian is the manager of Zhen Linen in Los Angeles, a family-owned linen service for large events that started selling handmade face masks back in April. She joins me now. Orjen, what was business like before you started selling masks?
Well, we didn't have any business coming in because all the events were stopped. Before the pandemic, we were selling linen, tablecloths, napkins, table runners, drapery, since we work on really big events, over 300 people. Mm-hmm. And all events had stopped, we had to figure out something else. And once the mayor had announced that he wants to see all residents wearing cloth face masks, that's when we started. So I remember he announced it on April 7th. It took us about 2 days to come up with our design and how we're going to do it. And then we announced on April 9th that we're going to start selling them. And from then it took off.
And when you say it took off, what kind of numbers have you seen in terms of sales?
In April and the beginning of May, it boomed. So overall, we sold about 31,000 face masks.
Wow.
That may not sound like a big number for a large company, but for us, that's huge for a month. We saw sales in April that we've never seen before. That was our best month that we've seen to date. And that also goes to show that we were able to react to the market really quickly, and that because we are producing in LA, we don't outsource anything. So we have that advantage of being able to produce rapidly here in LA.
Well, and were you selling mostly to people in LA or all over the country?
No, so we were selling on Etsy, eBay, for a moment, and we were also selling locally too, but local sales in LA weren't as much as it was on Etsy. So it was mainly e-commerce. And Etsy lets us sell worldwide. So at first, we started only United States. We saw sales everywhere.
Wow.
And then we recently opened up channels to international. It's slow internationally, but there are still orders.
Well, and now that we're in June and some places around the United States have started to open up again, has demand for the masks kept up or is it plateauing now that people have already bought masks?
Yeah, demand is slow now. There is still demand for it, but it's not how we saw it in April. It's not the same.
Well, so what do you plan to do? Are you going to stay in the mask business for a while, or do you plan to go back to linens and the kinds of things you were doing before?
We're able to do both. We're still going to be selling masks until probably the end of the year, until we see demand has really shifted into like nothing anymore. So we're still going to be able to provide masks and sell them. We might come out with new styles, maybe incorporate some embroidering into our masks. So if someone wants a custom mask with their name, we can be able to do that. We're looking into that. So we still want to expand, but we don't want a large inventory, just surplus. We want to be able to also get everything out of our warehouse to prepare it for whenever events do open up again, that we have space for our regular business, because we specialize in our linen supply. And we still have events that we have planned for the end of the year and for next year. So we do hope to go back to our normal business, and we do hope that this is a temporary time for us.
Now, you're dealing with something that a lot of small businesses have started to deal with more and more during this crisis, which is that you make a product, you use a bigger company like Etsy in this case to sell, and then in some cases, they get a cut of the money that's coming in. And in the case of Etsy, the company angered some sellers when they announced a new ad policy this year that automatically advertises sellers' products and then takes a 12 to 15% cut of the revenue that ad makes. What's your feeling about that?
It's difficult to say, because I understand that there's a platform they give us to sell and that we don't have to go out there and look for buyers. Etsy gives us that platform. They give us the buyers. There's a lot that goes behind the website that we don't see. But I think it's a little bit too harsh, and they should come up with a different type of a solution to the advertising than to just charge small businesses and individuals without letting them opt out.
Do you wear a mask everywhere you go?
In public, yes. But if I am not around people, no.
Yeah. They're not that comfortable.
No, not at all.
And this is from a mask maker.
And especially in Los Angeles, it's 90 degrees outside here. So it's difficult to breathe in them.
That is Orjen Rushanian, who is the manager of Zhen Linen in Los Angeles, which started selling handmade face masks on Etsy back in April. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Mask maker, make me a mask. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.